Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to get parenthood right? As anybody who has kids can tell you, raising young children is a sort of daily balancing act between your fierce love for the little people who so need you and the stark reality that nobody in the world can push more of your buttons. The job requires us to teach our children right from wrong, make them feel loved, and keep them clean, well-fed, and safe. And ultimately, it leads us to discover, as parents, a new facet of ourselves as people. GQ correspondent Drew McGarry writes about his experiences in his new memoir, Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood. Drew, welcome to Think.
Hey, good to be here.
So I always say that you're never a better parent than before you actually have any kids. How does your behavior as a father compare with the image maybe that you had of yourself before you had kids?
Oh, you always have that idealistic idea of what kind of parent you're going to be, right? It's like, well, I'll never spank them, and I'll never yell at them like my dad yelled at me, and I'll serve them only organic fruits and vegetables and like... You know that it's going to be hard, but you have certain things that you want to do, you have certain ideas about what you want to do with them that end up getting thrown out the window. Like, I want my kids to eat right, but they don't eat anything, so I end up giving them, you know, like half a corn dog for dinner. Like,
right.
That's just how it goes. I didn't have expectations for my kids. I had certain things that I hoped to be able to accomplish as a parent that I just utterly failed to do.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you have these pictures of yourself, you know, taking them to the park and you know, maybe reading to them. And all that does happen. It's just that those are little tiny pinpricks of fantastic, you know, moments of life in between a lot of brush your teeth, go to bed, take a shower, that kind of thing.
Well, even reading is frustrating. Like, you ever read to a kid for like 30 minutes? Like, it's tiring. It's just, and if it's the same book over and over again, or if you're sitting on a couch and your back starts to hurt and you have to hold open the book and your wrist gets sore, it's very tiring.
How did you spend your last months of freedom before you had your first child?
I drank a lot. Yeah, I did my best to be, it was back when I didn't really know any better, and it was like, well, I gotta have fun. I think every guy that, you know, right before they have kids, they have this sort of freak out like, oh, God, party's over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really true. You know, I think most guys that have kids eventually adjust and they figure out their own ways to have fun with the kids or without.
It is interesting, though. This happened to you, and I think it happens in a lot of couples. You were sort of enjoying your last moments of freedom. Meanwhile, your wife, who was carrying your daughter at the time, was already like in a hyper protective mindset, to the extent that, like, you guys went to a concert and she was worried that the loud music could hurt the baby.
Yeah, she thought that, you know, the music would rock the fetus right out of her. You know, she was terrified. Because when you're a first time parent, you're just in heightened awareness of the baby inside you and what's going to happen to it and all this stuff. By the time you have the third kid, you're happily leaving them like a toxic waste dump. Stop rhyming, but it doesn't work with the first one. It's the only kid you have and you don't know what you're doing. So you're terrified you're going to do it wrong and all that stuff.
Yeah, and especially, you know, you read so much when you're pregnant with that first one because there's nothing to do but that, right?
You
buy all the stuff and then you've got to educate yourself and you have nothing to do but worry.
Yeah, that's right, and they take you through every possible scenario and every question. You know, what if my breastfed baby, gets herpes or something? You find all these elaborate scenarios, and the books are always telling you, don't worry. Like, it's always like, don't worry, you'll be all right. Oh, but the kid might get SIDS and die, within the first year. Like, it's always that sort of push and pull where you're going to worry no matter what.
Yeah. Did you guys read those What to Expect books?
Of course.
Yeah.
Those are
the worst.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, the wife will read them cover to cover and then say, well, you should read this. And then I read it and I like, you know, I glance at like five different pages scattered throughout the text. I say, oh, yeah, I read it.
Yeah, I remember they've made them a little less terrifying, but just every little thing in there kind of is an admonition of something you've probably already done wrong.
Yeah, oh, the other thing is that, you know, with those books, half the time, I use it as a reference book, like, okay, well, the baby's throwing up blood. Well, what's going on? And then I don't know what to look up in the index. Like, I can't find, like, I can't, I, do I look under throwing up? Do I look under barf? Do I look under vomit? And do I look under blood, you know, comma, vomiting up? Like, it's, and I can never find the reference in time. Or it's not there.
Yeah.
Or it applies to some other kid. Like, it's, you know, it's a kid that's vomiting blood, but it's a homeschooled vomiting blood kid. So it's not...
Totally
like,
different thing, right.
Yeah, it's some totally different circumstance that I can't use for my own.
You know, we're kind of laughing about all this, but you actually open the book with a profoundly frightening scene. And your newborn son, who was born premature, was found to have a potentially life-threatening problem. And you weren't a new father by this time. You had, you know, two other children. But I get the sense that this was the first time you had felt like there was nothing you could do.
Yeah, and it was, you know, in some odd way, even though I loved my first two kids, I sort of had taken them for granted because they were healthy. They were relatively healthy and all that stuff. And once they, you know, once that sort of that bubble is burst and you're confronted with them being in mortal danger, it's just different than, you know, they always say that the having the kid changes you, but it's not really true. I was still sort of an idiot when I had my kid. But then... After my son got very sick and had to be operated on, that did change me in a much more fundamental level.
How seriously did you allow yourself to consider the possibility that he might not make it?
Oh, it was all I thought about.
Yeah,
it was all, you know, we were in this hospital and I just, you know, if they tell you that your son could die, then that's what you think about.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way of avoiding it. I mean, you want to have a good attitude and all that stuff because you think on some psychosomatic level that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I kept thinking about it. I kept envisioning it in my head. And, you know, I do that as a parent now. I do it as a parent even when they're all okay, you know. If they, you know, if their bus is late, if their bus is 10 minutes late, well, then it's okay. Well, did the bus crash? Or, did the bus crash into a frozen lake? Like,
mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, you always feel as if those sort of life and death moments are never all that far away.
Yeah, and I guess it really is. It's the thing that makes parenthood different from any other relationship you will ever have. Because, and, you know, people worry about their kids getting, you know, being victims of crime. And you just feel like this child is so precious and perfect and that the whole world is out to sort of, you know, not hurt them necessarily.
Ruin.
But, yeah.
Yeah, spoil them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the constant fear too. It's you want them to go out and be kids and all that stuff, but at the same time, you know, there's a whole internet with thousands of trillions of pages of porn on it, and then there's, you know, there's other kids who like stabbing other kids in the eye and stuff. And it's, you know, you have to sort of find this balance between being too protective and being too hippy dippy. You know, just let the kid go do anything. And I think it's hard for parents in this day and age to find the right balance. And I think it becomes very, very frustrating for them when they can't find it, you know, and they're very, you know, aware of how the world is perceiving them if they're screwing up.
Yeah, it is the one thing you can't get wrong, right? You can explain away your career not going right. You can explain away not having money or having too much money or spending it wrong, but you really don't want to mess up your kids.
Yeah, if your kid ends up, you know, stripping or in the porn business, then people think it's you. You did it, you know?
Yeah. And then there's nothing to make you question yourself, like looking at other parents who seem to have it all together.
Yeah, that's always annoying. Like if they're in a restaurant and all the kids are seated and they're eating the things that are on the menu, that's so. It's like they've been planted there to make you feel awful. It's just horrible.
Yeah. So I really love the chapter where you write about this sort of pitched battle between you and your then 5-year-old daughter, and it's this contest of wills, and clearly hers is every bit as strong as yours.
Much, much stronger. I mean, because the thing about kids is, they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have anything to do. So if they're gonna, you know, if they want to sit in their room and bang on the door as loudly as possible for 3 hours, they're happy to do it because what else are they going to do? They don't have a hot date to go on.
Yeah, and I guess they also, there's this sense that if you are not really careful, you get drawn into an argument as if you too are a 5-year-old.
Yeah, and, you know, that's always the problem is that, you know, if I ever get into a fight with my kid, I constantly think back to, you know, when I was a kid, I was like, well, I did what my dad says,
mm-hmm.
right? That's what my wife and I always say when we're wrestling with our kid. We're like, well, we did what our dad said. What's wrong with these kids? And then you really want it, and you try and force it so that they conform the way you think you conformed. And then when they don't, you just get more angry and more frustrated. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. And so, you know, I've gotten better, a lot better since then about not sort of engaging. And, you know, you have to manage your kids. It's a job of management. And, you know, as someone who has limited, like, experience in the oversight of other human beings, it can be tough to figure out.
Yeah, it is funny because they look to you to answer every question.
Right.
And there's a lot of questions every day.
Yeah. It's just, it's mentally exhausting. And then, you know, they present you with problems where you have to figure out some sort of creative solution that doesn't involve you hitting them with a kendo stick. And that's, you know, that takes a lot of energy. That takes a lot of brain power. And it's just, you know, it's not necessarily manual labor, but it can be draining no matter what.
And you do have some creative solutions here. You write about, you know, trying to get a kid in the tub who just does not want to do this. And you realize, okay, you can pick your battles here.
Yeah, or I mean, you can. I mean, it's difficult because you want them to do. You want them to listen. You want them to do what you're trying to do. But there has to be some sort of elegant solution to it. In my case, it was just telling my kid dirty jokes, which was probably the wrong way to go, but it worked.
Dirty jokes like poop jokes, not dirty sexual
jokes.
Yeah,
like poop jokes, like butt jokes. Mm-hmm. And stuff. Because butts are funny to kids. Because mm-hmm. Everyone has a butt, and they're always sticking out their butts and all that stuff. And it worked, but of course, it's at the price of, well, now she knows all these terrible butt jokes.
Right. Well, do you and your wife handle these things differently, and do you try to influence one another?
Well, that's the thing. You know, the parenting books in the classes always tell you the same thing: is to be consistent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, where my wife and I always get, you know, testy with one another, where it's like, we're not being consistent. You did X and I did Y, and then you're like, well, you weren't around. I didn't know you were doing Y, and it's like, well, I always have that thing where it's like, you know, I get into a fight with my daughter because I don't want her to have, like, a Twizzler or something like that. But it turned out my wife said she could have a Twizzler, like, 15 minutes ago.
Right.
Right? And I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, there was one time when you're, like, on the phone with your dad and your daughter is acting up, and you don't want your dad to think that you're not handling this appropriately. And it is funny. We do still want to sort of, regardless of how anybody was raised, you still want your parents to be proud of your parenting.
Yeah, and you will be better than them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I want them to look and be like, oh, man, I could have raised you better than that.
Hmm.
Or I could have raised you better than I did. And it never happens that way. The grandparents always look over and they're like, yeah, you sure you want to do that? And you're like, shut up.
Yeah, it's funny how they mellow over time, too.
They do. They mellow, and yet they're annoying, and they're subtly annoying in all their little ways. All it takes is them to just say one thing, and you're like, get out of here.
Now, do you have siblings with kids?
Yes. My brother has two kids, and my sister has three kids. And they're just as confused. And,
well, that's got to be comforting.
Yeah. It is. We call each other, and we're like, oh, you know, what are you doing? And then we hear the kids screaming in the background. We're like, well, I know you got to go.
My guest is Drew McGarry. He's a correspondent for GQ and a columnist for Deadspin and Gawker. His new book is called Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood. You're welcome to join the conversation by asking a question. Maybe you want to tell a story of your own adventures in parenting. You can do that by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a columnist for Deadspin and Gawker, also a correspondent for GQ. Drew McGarry's new book is called Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Drew, you share a story here about drinking too much. You get pulled over for DWI. You have to take classes. Did you hesitate given the tone of the rest of the book, did you hesitate to share that story?
No, not really. It was something I wanted to write about for a while, especially when I paid my lawyer. I was like, well, if I'm going to pay this much money, I may as well get some writing out of it. Hmm. And I think it was just sort of a natural thing to write about in talking about how I've sort of, you know, I hate to say, it sounds so boring to say how I've evolved or how I've matured as a parent. It's just one of those things that, you know, you have kids and you're still some remnants of your youth that are still there. And, you know, it doesn't happen overnight when you have the kid that you change. It's, you know, it's sort of gradually step by step. And, you know, when I got arrested, it was like, it was one of those things where I was like, well, I can't do this anymore. This is stupid. But it took that long for me to figure it out. And I think the chapter is just sort of one of those examples of me, you know, figuring it out on the fly and wishing that I had figured it out earlier.
Do you think that our generation of parents is somehow more resistant to the idea that this means the end of our own childhoods than maybe our parents were?
Oh, I think that is true in some cases. I think that we are much more determined to stay selfish and enjoy ourselves as this generation. And yet, I say all that, but then, you know, my parents would be like, well, we just left you and had our little cocktail hour, you know. And so, you know, I guess it's weird because I guess we're more selfish, and yet when we do the helicopter thing, then the older generation is like, well, you're too hands-on. You're doing too much. And again, it's that push and pull where I don't know what the solution is. I don't really know if I'm doing it wrong or if I have it balanced correctly or not.
It is interesting the amount of stuff that parents do that is like zero fun for you because you know that your kids enjoy it. Will you tell us about your trip to Funland?
Yeah, we went to a seaside amusement park, and they have, you know, they have all the rides. They have, you know, they have the thing that spins around and the floor goes out and you throw up, and they had, you know, the scramblers, and they had little things that spin around, like little cars you can sit in and all that stuff. And then my son got trapped in, like, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but, like, these sort of big jungle gym contraptions. But it's not like a jungle gym. That's not doing it justice. It's like a giant structure with, like, tunnels and netting and ball pits. And the kid goes in, and, like, half an hour later they come out. And my kid got trapped in this. And I can't go in, like, it's not designed for me to go into, and I can't go and rescue him. Mm-hmm. So he's stranded up there, and, like the dude operating is too stoned to go help, and I have to go sit there and sort of, like, talk him through, like I'm a hostage negotiator. And it's just one of those things where you're, like, you're sitting there watching your kids struggle, and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm playing a sport and failing at it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Josh in Addison. Hey, Josh.
Hi. Really enjoying the show. Quick, very short story about, I'm not a parent myself, but I can relate to what your author's saying. I watch my neighbor's, he was 2.5 years old at the time, he's about 3 or 3.5 now, son. And they never explained to me, I don't know how old you need to be to when you stop wearing diapers or pull-ups, but he was still wearing, like, diapers, pull-up kinds of things. And they never explained to me what to do in case there was a necessity to change them. And one day, we had to change them. And my idea, not being a parent, not knowing what to do, was basically get them into the bathtub, strip them down, hose them off, and then we're all clean and changed, and we don't have to really deal with bodily stuff. And it wasn't working for him. He was screaming so loud because he didn't want to get in the tub that I actually seriously wondered how old you have to be to have a heart attack or a stroke. two and a half, maybe too young, I don't know. So I put it off, and we just let it go. And his father got home, and my instincts were confirmed because I told him, you know, Elric needs to be changed. And, of course, he started screaming immediately, and his dad picked him up, took him into the bathroom, put him in the tub, stripped him down, hosed him off, and that was the end of it. And he quit screaming about halfway through. So I kind of treat him now like I pretty much, if there's a problem, I just go with the solution and kind of ignore the screaming, and I hope that's the right way to handle kids that age.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really understand how much noise they can make until you have the kid or you're around the kid, and they start just producing just decibels, just oceans of decibels of sound. You can't believe it, and you think, well, this kid has, like, liver failure or something like that. But they don't. That's just what they do.
And then they'll turn around and surprise you and be the sweetest things that you can imagine.
Of course. And then you're like, oh, that made it all worth it. Aw, aw.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to David in Grapevine. Hi, David.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
Good. I love the show so far. So I had an observation as well as a question for you. The observation is I'm a father of two, just over 2 years old and younger, and I used to work at a school with monks. And one of them asked me how it was going. I said, you know, we're just not trying not to drop around your head. And he said, you know, children are resilient. And it struck me as funny that a Catholic monk, who by definition has never raised a child, gave me probably the best observation/advice I've ever heard about parenting. And since then, whenever I worry about, am I a good parent? Am I doing things wrong? I just dropped around her head. I remember that. So my question related to that observation is, you know, are there times when you just kind of laugh at how great a parent you think you're going to be and then realizing that you're going to make mistakes probably all along the way for decades, and if you have any observations along those lines?
Well, I think like when they hit their head, right? Like when they hit their head the first time, you're so alarmed. You're like, oh, my God, they have a concussion. They got to get CTE. We have to go get a brain scan and all that stuff, and you're just terrified, and you don't want them to hit their head again. But then, like, with my son, like, he starts just hitting his head on everything, like, 20 times a day, just bang, bang, just using his head as just a human drumstick. And, you know, after a while, you throw your hands up, and you're like, okay, well, clearly he's just learning how to use his head, and, you know, he'll figure out on his own that he shouldn't bash his face into the wall and all that stuff. And it's true, when the monk told you the kids are resilient, like, they mean it, not only they mean it emotionally, but it's true physically. Like, they can take a beating. Like, they can fall off the bike, and they get up and they're like, I'm okay, and they get back on, and, like, their knee's bleeding and all that stuff. And they are remarkably, like, they are, you know, they have, like, bones made of rubber. They are remarkably damage-proof.
How did you end up the only dad in gymboree class?
I was like, my wife had talked me into it, and I was like, well, I'm going to be the only man there. And she's like, no, there are men there. And I go, of course, I'm the only man there. I'm like, this is no good. And I don't know. I think it was one of those things where I was a new dad, and if I had to do it now, like, I could take a baby to a gymboree class, and I wouldn't care. But back then, I was very self-conscious. It was, you know, I'm the dad, so I'm the only one who, you know, by default doesn't know what he's doing. All the women will be staring at me and waiting for me to screw up. And, of course, I screwed up, and then they, you know, my kid starts crying, and all the women are looking at me, like, and I'm like, take your eyes off of me, you witches, you know.
Do you think, you know, it's interesting, I've read a lot more memoirs written by moms than by dads, but, of course, they're out there. Do you think that there's a different culture, like women are more judgmental and guys are more apt to be honest about their failings?
No, not necessarily. I think women tend to be more, like, you know, give a mother a glass of wine and she'll spill the beans right away. Like, I think men tend to be more guarded and I think they're just awkward sometimes interacting with each other. You know, a lot of times when you're talking to other parents, you're talking to them out of circumstantial reasons because you're standing outside of school or you're standing at a bus stop. You don't really have anything in common with them. You wouldn't hang out with them, like, ever, right? And for guys, that's a very uncomfortable situation because you're like, hey, I'm 36. I already made all my friends. I don't want to make any more small talk with other human beings. You just, men are just more naturally inclined to occasionally be antisocial and withdraw. And, you know, that's usually bad. You know, that's usually not as good for them. And, you know, I think it does them a disservice. So I try my best to be a bit more outgoing in those sorts of situations.
Do most of your real friends have kids now?
Yeah. And then everyone has the one friend who's like still a bachelor,
right?
You know, and it's like, you know, he's, you know, and you're like, why don't you just get married so we can hang out more, right? Like, I can't hang out with you while you're out at like a club, you know, like I can't do that, you know, like, and you don't want to be the old yenta who's constantly trying to be matchmaker for your friend, but you're like, you become a tight ass. You're like, hey, why don't you settle down so we can all hang out.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Sam who says, my wife left on a business trip for a week and I felt the torment of getting the kids to school on time. They never liked the clothes I picked for them or the breakfast I made, and they turned getting ready into a great racing contest. I was waking up earlier and earlier and eventually resorted to dressing them for school while they were asleep, and it worked.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, the thing that's horrifying with that kind of situation is you want them to go to the bus stop, right, so they can go to school.
Yeah.
They don't have to, right? You have to get them to want to do it, because if they don't want to do it, they'll just sit there. And what are you going to do? Like, are you going to pick them up and throw them into the bus? Like, you can't do that. And that's the sort of terrifying moment for a parent. That's the moment where you're like, you know, I only have so much control over them, where I have to, you know, I have to figure out a way to get them to want to do this, as opposed to just forcing them to do it. And that's really, really hard. That's always the toughest thing for me. Like, when I make something for them to eat and they don't eat it, I can't, you know, force their mouths open like they're a goose and like stuff like food down a funnel, you know. But I want to. Like, I feel the urge to just be like, ugh, do this, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I guess you have to figure out, and they're all different, right? The stuff that motivates them to do the things they're not really interested in doing. I don't know about you, but my multiple children, you can't convince them the same way.
Right, no, of course not. And that's what's so annoying about it, you know?
So talk about this. You have dealt with the common scourge that I think most people with kids in elementary school have dealt with, and that is lice. Can you talk about how you discovered that this had befallen your family?
Well, like, my kid just got, she got off and she started scratching her head, and my wife was like, well, she might have lice. And I was like, no, she's clean. She's not a dirty pig pen type kid. And then, of course, she did have lice. And you realize that it's not necessarily about cleanliness. And I say that to defend my daughter's honor, but it's just random thing that happens. When it happens, it destroys you. Like, it just destroys the whole house. You have to vacuum it out of all the carpets and all that horrible stuff. And you realize how the whole world, you don't understand how the whole world just doesn't have lice constantly all the time, because there's no lice. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I guess it is, they say it's true that lice don't necessarily like the dirty hair. They like the clean hair. But I've wondered if that's to make parents feel better.
It's probably to make them feel better.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's that sense of like treating your child like a disease vector is something you want to avoid, and yet you sort of can't help it.
Yeah, you have to sort of sequester them, make sure they don't go rubbing their heads on other people and all that stuff.
So how do your kids interact with one another?
Well, that's the whole other thing, is that, you know, when you have two kids, you know it's going to be double the work because it's two kids, but then you don't realize the sort of how much management you have to do to get them to get along, or at least if they don't get along, to have them be in separate places and all that stuff. And that is its own exhausting process. Like, that is like, oh, God, you know. Like, I don't think I was quite ready for, you know, the whole sort of sibling rivalry thing, even though there are 5 million books about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, the hardest, the biggest challenge. Because when you have, like, an older daughter and she's wailing on your son, you want to wail on the daughter, right? You want exact revenge for the aggrieved party, and it doesn't work that way. You can't do that.
So have you figured out ways to keep them getting along?
Yeah, I mean, 90% of it is you have to let them fight. I mean, I'm not saying like with brass knuckles or anything,
yeah.
But if they have a disagreement, just don't get in the middle of it. They need to figure it out on their own, and usually most of the time they do.
Yeah, it's interesting that apparently, you know, them fighting with their siblings is a really good way to practice conflict resolution as adults.
Right.
And that sounds good, but then you think about the way that kids fight, and you hope they don't fight that way when they're grown up.
Yeah, and it sucks to be there when they're yelling at each other. Like, it's just I don't want them screaming in my face, and I don't want them throwing stuff at each other. So half the time, I just have to, like, look away, right? I can't even look. Like, I can't even watch, because otherwise I'll intervene if I see them, you know, fighting over, you know, the donor's kidney that they both want or something like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Diane in Fort Worth. Hey, Diane.
Hi. Well, I just heard him talk about lies, and I just wanted to share a story. I have four daughters, and several of them ended up with lice. And I went through this whole, I had no idea how to deal with it, but I went to the store and got the products, and then I was just shampooing them with the products and I decided to put little shampoo caps over their heads to try to really kill the lice.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it over and over again trying to kill them, and the eggs kept showing up. So I started to worry about the poisonous effects and the fumes, and maybe it wasn't such a good thing to just soak them in this red stuff.
Right.
So I ended up pulling the eggs out of my daughter's hair one strand at a time, because she had to go to Girl Scout camp.
How long did that take?
It took a long time. And the next day at Girl Scout camp, we did it the day before she had to be there, and there was I'm pretty sure egg dust in her hair, because they were looking her over so good. I felt so bad for her, but she made the cut. But so, I pulled them out section by section, and that's what I've told other mothers to do at times. I sectioned it off with clippies, and I pulled every egg out with my fingernails.
We are talking this hour about adventures in parenting. Thanks, Diane. Our guest for the hour is GQ correspondent Drew McGarry. His new book is called Someone Could Get Hurt, A Memoir of 21st Century Parenthood. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Drew McGarry. His new book is called Someone Could Get Hurt, A Memoir of 21st Century Parenthood. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. If you had to, like, write a list of your strengths and weaknesses, Drew, what are you better at than you might have imagined?
I don't know if I'm better at anything. I think I'm better now at just managing the kids and stepping away, like we said before, like not engaging, like not trying to intervene in sibling arguments, or like not trying to get into those power struggles. I'm much better at that now.
Yeah.
I'm also good at like any dad, I'm good at like roughhousing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good at like wrestling my kid to the ground and throwing him in the air and they go, "Oh, dad," and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. They never will say, "Mommy, let's wrestle." It's always dad.
Yeah, always. Mom's always a little jealous, like, "Hey, I wish they always asked for you to play with them." And I'm like, I finally have something over you.
You've been really good in this hour, and I so appreciate it, about language, because you are, you know, you talk like adults talk. Have you had to be careful about the words you use around your kids?
Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, at some point they're going to find out about them and use them. So all you can really do is model your behavior so that they don't feel like it's necessary to use those words. Of course, it's totally necessary to use those words. But I do my best to rein myself in. And you know what's amazing is that, you know, a lot of times I've let it slip, mm-hmm. right? I've let an F-bomb slip, or I've let an S-bomb slip. And you know, kids usually mimic everything you say, everything you do. But I've done it around my kids, and they, for some reason, they mysteriously have not caught on to it. Like, my oldest kid knows the F-bomb, and she said it once. She was like, "Dad, what is F a bad word?" And I said, "Yeah, you'll get thrown in the office. You'll get, you know, you go to the principal's office for using it and stuff like that." But I was very, I downplayed it. I wasn't like, "Oh, where'd you learn that?"
Right, right.
And she hasn't used it since. And so now I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop for her to finally bust it out again. But it's, they've shown it actually, you know, given my profession and given the stuff that I write online, they've shown a remarkable amount of restraint when it comes to cursing. That'll end, like, by the time they're 14.
Well, I guess kids are like anybody else. I mean, just as they learn grammar, they learn that there are, like, rare occasions, I suppose, when certain words get pulled out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, one time, I said, "Damn it!" Except I put the G
right,
or D
right
in front of it, and whenever I get frustrated, like I say that, I was like, "Oh, for crying out loud!" But you know that word. And one time, when my kid, she dropped something, she said it exactly as I said it, and she did it so well that I just laughed. And that's the thing. I think that's the hardest thing for parents is that. Most of the time when they do it, it's really funny. Like, it's really, really funny. And you can't laugh because then they know that they've got good material and then they keep using it.
Yeah.
But, and so I try my best to contain myself, but I was just over the moon. I thought it was so funny.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Danny on the line in Grapevine. Hey, Danny.
Hi, how you doing? I was just wondering, I was a stay-at-home dad for 5 years. And, it's been a while back, you know, it's been about 4 years now, but I encountered, kind of a lot of prejudice out there, and I was wondering if you saw the same thing.
Wait, say it again?
I encountered a lot of prejudice out in the world, as a stay-at-home dad, and I wondered if you encountered the same thing. Like, you know, I'd be shunned at the park, or I'd go to reading time at the library, and, you know, I'd say, "Okay, moms," when I'm like, "Hello, I'm right here in the front row."
I think that's a problem for the stay-at-home dads, because as much as we want to say we're an enlightened society, I think that, you know, men are still expected to be sort of go-getters and ambitious people who bring home the bacon and all that stuff. And so even though we're supposed to be sort of open to the idea of stay-at-home dads, they still get the looks, right? They still get the, well, he doesn't have a job, right? Mm-hmm. He's unemployed. And he's just, you know, there's always a sense that this is temporary.
Which is interesting, because no one would say about a stay-at-home mom, "Well, she's unemployed."
Of course not. No, we would never do that. And that's just, those are just standards that have just not, they've just stuck around, and they probably will stick around for longer. And it's very difficult for modern fathers, even modern moms, to figure out how to sort of keep the balance where they're fulfilling this modern role, either as a working mom or as a stay-at-home dad, but also fulfilling this traditional role of either caregiver or breadwinner.
Hmm. Has your, all that said, did becoming a father change your sense of yourself as, like, provider for your family?
I just think that it makes you more aware that you have to start making money because the kid's going to need so much of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, oh my God, this thing's going to cost a fortune. Like, I just instantly, like, the kid was born, and I was like, okay, well, now I need $200,000 for college, you know, and even that's not going to be enough, right? And where do you get that money from? So you have to start thinking about, okay, well, I need to make a lot of money, and I don't quite know how to do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Do you think you can imagine what your kids are going to be like as adults?
No, and that's sort of the fun of it. You know, like when my daughter was 3, I couldn't imagine her at 7. And now that she's 7, I can't imagine what she'll be like at 10. And that's sort of the fun of it. I think when you have the expectations, when you put expectations on them, you have an exact vision of what they want to be, they're going to subvert it. They're going to be different from what you expect. So there's no point in sort of setting yourself up for disappointment or anger or anything like that.
Yeah, it does seem like parents today are less invested in, like, planning a specific career for their kids than maybe they once were.
Yeah, I think it's really stayed in old-fashioned to be like, well, he'll go to Harvard and he'll become a doctor. Like, I think that's very weird.
How did you guys decide on 3 kids?
I didn't.
Well, you had part of this.
I had nothing to do with it. We knew we wanted two because mm-hmm. just one kid was just, I don't know, we just didn't want one kid who was like, you know, spoiled rotten by us. So we wanted two. And then my wife was like, well, I've always wanted to be in a big family because she was from two. She was one of two kids. I was one of three. And I was like, you know what? It's not that great to be in a big family. And she's like, no. And eventually she wore me down. Then we had another one. So there you go.
And are you constantly looking for the ways that they take after each of you?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. I mean, you're just sort of, you're very aware of the relationship between them and you and all that stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. If you've got a story about parenthood or you simply want to share, let's go next on the phone to Doug in Dallas. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I had a story about taking my son when he was 8 or 9 years old to the State Fair of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And we got on one of those rides that suspends you upside down at the top of a loop for a while, and we were both really unhappy and uncomfortable. And we came down and walked around for a while, and after a while we started feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to go on the one with the swings that go around in a circle. You sit on a swing seat.
Right, and centrifugal force kind of whips you out there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, I should have known better because I don't have a good stomach for that. And so right about the time we were getting ready to stop, I just couldn't help myself, and I lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And my son was really amazing because he became the parent at that point, and he was so concerned about me. And we went into a men's room, and he helped me clean up. And, you know, it was really kind of gratifying, actually, to see that this 8 or 9 year old kid was you know, assuming the parental role in that situation.
That's a great story.
They tend to rise to the occasion. You know what I mean? Like they'll be really annoying around you, you know. But then you send them out into the world, and they do a pretty good job. And you're like, oh wow, they're going to be okay. And then they come back home and they annoy you.
Right. Yeah, there's nothing better than getting the report from some other parent that your child has way better manners than theirs, because it's never true at home.
Yeah, no, of course not, because they just know there are things they can get away with you. And, you know, it's amazing. You go to their school, and when they're told to line up, they line up. When they're told to eat, they eat. And when they're told not to do something, they stop doing it.
Yeah, what do you think it is about the authority of school?
I just think it's just people who, the schools are always consistent, and the schools just aren't around them enough for them to feel comfortable. Like, there's always a bit of, well, I don't know what's going to happen here.
Yeah, that makes sense, that they still, no matter what, they know that mom and dad are going to be there for them no matter how badly they act up.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Were you keeping a journal throughout your kid's early childhood, or how did you assemble the book?
I sort of went through and all my memories, and there were certain things I knew I was going to write about anyway, like my arrest and like my son's stint in the NICU and stuff. So I knew there were certain points I was going to hit. And then I go through pictures and, you know, sort of go through all my memories and things that I wanted to hit on. Anything that I found entertaining, anything that had sort of deeper humor, you know?
Yeah. Are you hearing from people who feel that your approach is refreshing?
I mean, you hear that occasionally, and, you know, look, people like to commiserate and stuff like that. I think, you know, that's nice. It's nice when anything you write connects with people, and sort of you start a dialogue between you and them, at least in your head.
Yeah. What do you think about, you know, the day that, if you could choose the age they are when they pick this book up, would it be 12? Would it be 21? Would it be 30 when they are having their first kids?
What, my kids?
Yeah.
No, they can't ever read it. 80. When I'm dead.
Well, there's going to be nothing they want to read more. You realize
that. Of course not. Now, my kid, my 7-year-old, she's like, oh, cool. She's looking. And I'm like, no. Not you.
Now, you didn't use their names in the book. Why is that?
Well, mostly for a stylistic reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just when you name your kids, they're automatically mine, and people are like, I don't care about your kid.
Yeah.
You know, when you don't name them, the people can put their own kids in that situation much more easily.
Kind of universal. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's go back to the phones one more time. We have Ray on the line in Dallas. Hey, Ray.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, so question for Drew. You know, I'm 36 years old. I've got two kids, and they're young. They're two and a baby. And, you know, one of the things I wonder about is when I was growing up, the most difficult conversation a parent has with their kid is about, you know, the birds and the bees kind of thing. But now I find that I'm actually more scared of how to explain things that I see on the news to my kids, like especially if something like Sandy Hook happens. You know, how do you – I was wondering just how as Drew ever thought about, you know, as his kids get older, what would he say to, you know, what would you say to your kids when they're old enough to understand these kinds of things that happen in the world? How, you know, sort of going overboard and again, I guess how you would deal with it internally. Like, how do you deal with what you would think about it versus what you would say to your kids about it?
Yeah, I had to deal with talking to my kid about Sandy Hook because it happened on Friday, and then I'd tell her about it on Saturday or Sunday before she went to school. Because he's new, you have to talk to him about it because their peers, if one of their peers finds out, then all of them find out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things where you try to find the right balance between giving them information and giving them, you know, you give them the information, you give them the truth of it, without getting too detailed about. Because they'll ask you, you know, well, did you shoot people in the head? Like they'll ask for that level of detail. And you give what you can, and you can't be afraid for them to sort of take dark events and go into dark mental places with it. It's not bad for them to think about death or think about bad things. It's bad if they wallow in it. But in general, if you tell them about it and then you reassure them, hey, you're safe and we're here and we love you and all that stuff, all that usually wash out okay.
Is there a favorite part of the day when you're with your kids? Is it like breakfast? Is it bedtime? Is it, you know, story time?
It's not 3 to 5 p.m. I know what it's not. It's not then. Morning is not bad. They're usually pretty chill in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Or like right after, you know, getting off the school bus and stuff like that. That's always fun.
Yeah. But then between getting off the school bus at 3 and 5, things take a downward turn?
Oh, yeah. They give you a hug and then they go crazy for an hour.
Yeah. I guess they have to blow off steam.
Yeah, of course.
How is your youngest son today? Do you mind my asking?
He is alive and well, so all good.
Good.
Let's hope.
Drew McGarry is a correspondent for GQ magazine. He's also a columnist for Deadspin and Gawker. His new book is called Someone Could Get Hurt, a memoir of 21st century parenthood. Drew, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
Sure, anytime.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.